300 million to more than half a billion dollars. That is the budget hole the MBTA could face in fiscal year 2022, and that's after figuring out how to fill a $720 million gap for this fiscal year. With a statewide unemployment rate right now that is the worst in the nation, more people working from home, high demand from essential workers on bus lines, and the risk of COVID-19 infection in closed spaces, how does our public transit bounce back? Well, let's turn to MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak to talk about that. Steve, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Well, thanks for having me again.
And listeners, if you have a question for the head of the T, call us. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve, yesterday we had Boston Mayor Marty Walsh on, and we were reflecting on the fact that the Commonwealth has now lived through basically 7 months of this pandemic. How are you? How's it going?
Oh, I'm fine. It's a challenge to manage in this environment, but you know, we are prioritizing obviously the safety of our employees and the safety of our vehicles and facilities. So, you know, we continue to provide service, and obviously you mentioned we are working through some pretty significant budget challenges right now.
Let's talk about that. You know, you said obvious it's a challenge to manage in this environment. We've been talking regularly over the last year. There were challenges before the pandemic, maintenance backlogs, capital improvements you were working on, pension fund liabilities. There were derailments last summer. Now here comes this pandemic and the financial impact of it. As concerned listeners, how do we put our heads around this deficit? How big a deal is this?
Well, it's a big deal. It's a deficit in the next fiscal year. Right now, we're in the beginning. Our fiscal year starts July 1. So right now, we are at the beginning of fiscal year 2021, which we have balanced in part with hundreds of millions of dollars in funding from the CARES Act. But we are already starting to look ahead to FY22, where we've got, you know, at least the $308 million deficit. And, you know, depending on how ridership trends, it could be worse. So we are starting to take action now in order to address that. And I think given the size and importance of the T, we need to start taking action now in fiscal year 2021 if we want to manage our way through fiscal 2022.
And to be clear, the CARES Act money is essential because without it and the ability to borrow, as I understand it, to pay labor for capital improvements, you might also in this fiscal year be facing about a $700 million gap. Is that right?
Yeah, all told, for the sort of the tail end of FY20, given that the COVID epidemic started in March, and in fiscal year 21, we will be utilizing the entire $827 million that we got in stimulus funding in order to make the budgets work for those 2 years.
So, Steve, I was looking at the projections, and so much of it relies on when ridership returns to certain levels of capacity, and 80% seems to be the big number that the $308 million projection is based on. Lots of variability there. Where is ridership now, and how does it compare to at the beginning of the pandemic? What's that kind of curve over the last 6 months looked like?
Sure. You know, ridership is somewhere between 15 and 20%, but I would say it is very variable between mode. The bus and the blue line and the ride are all at about 40% of the ridership that we had in late February. The rest of the subway system, red, orange, and green, is clustered around 20%. And then commuter rail and ferry is down closer to 10% ridership.
Has that stayed essentially flat, Steve, over the course of the pandemic so far? Or has ridership grown in one of those areas?
You know, they've all grown to some degree. We bottomed out sometime in April when bus was down at 20%. So bus has gone from 20% to 40%. The blue line was down at 15%. And then the other subway services were down, you know, 8 to 10%. So it has grown over this period. I think as more people have come out and as the governor's reopening phases have gone through, but we haven't seen big inflection points where, you know, another phase occurs and, you know, 5 to 10% of the ridership comes back all at once. We haven't seen that yet. We're going to pay special attention to the fall. You know, in September, is the return of college students going to cause an upward jump? BPS right now is going to be remote through November, so you know we don't expect that to cause a bump. And we'll see if certain offices open up a little bit more as well.
So just quickly, Steve, for our listeners, BPS will begin bringing students back into the classroom as the plan goes in a phased approach beginning in October, but students won't all be fully back in with the older grades not coming in until early to mid-November, just for our listeners. So if that is the case, these projections are looking at 80% ridership potentially by September 2021 or January 2022. What is happening in those projections that is taking ridership and the bus from 40% to 80% or on other forms of transportation from like 15 or 20% to 80%?
Yeah, we're not expecting to get up to 80% ridership until September 2022 in our projection. So September 2021, pardon me. That would be after this fiscal year is over. Right now we're doing the best we can to forecast scenarios where people gradually return, offices open up, and ridership increases. We did go through the exercise of saying, geez, what if the 80% number either comes significantly later or if it doesn't come at all? Unsurprisingly, if ridership doesn't come back, our budget situation becomes more difficult to solve just because the revenue isn't there.
Let's talk about buses for a minute. Steve, you were talking about ridership on buses, especially on certain lines, I think, really being higher significantly. We know from historic research that there's a correlation between reliance on bus and socioeconomic status, where you live in the city, race. It can be an economic and social justice issue, just as we have learned that patterns of spread and vulnerability and access to healthcare can also be racial justice and socioeconomic justice issues. So how are you thinking about this reliance on buses, and what are you doing to respond to it, to protect people's safety, to not have people too crowded together on buses?
You make a great point. It's our ridership on buses at 40%, but that is not evenly spread through bus lines. And we have we have a number of bus lines that serve economically disadvantaged areas there where ridership is significantly higher. And what we've done for the fall schedules is we have moved buses off of other lines where there is lower ridership. In some cases, we have suspended some routes, and we've put more capacity in the places where we have observed crowding. In addition, we continue to require masks on our vehicles. We also collect and distribute real-time crowding data for about 70% of our buses that you can get on MBTA.com and a number of third-party apps, so that if folks want to see how crowded is the bus that's coming towards me and is there a less crowded bus shortly behind it, they have that information for the people who have the flexibility to move their travel plans around. I fully acknowledge not everyone has that privilege.
Let's talk about masks, Steve. When we talked in May, you said that essentially the T couldn't enforce mask usage on the T for riders. And I wonder, is that still the policy of the T? Has that changed? I do know that masks are mandatory in order to ride the T, but what about enforcement?
Masks are required on the T as part, based on the governor's executive order. There's a couple exceptions for health in the executive order, and it also precludes you from demanding that people prove that they have a health condition. So it puts us in a position where we really need people to wear masks on the T for their safety and the safety of others. It puts us in a position where it would be difficult to enforce, and I think there's a number of problematic issues around making that a law enforcement issue. And I don't think there's any, I don't think there's any transit property in the country that is treating it as a law enforcement issue. We're really asking folks to comply with it. It's the right thing to do for yourself. It's the right thing to do for your fellow passengers and our employees.
So just to clarify, the T police, for example, do not have a role that they are now playing in enforcing mask usage on the T.
No, and in fact, I think the executive order does not, even if we wanted to, does not give them the opportunity to do that.
So how do you help riders feel safe then if, I mean, social media is full of memes and videos from all over the country of people refusing to wear masks inside all kinds of stores and buildings, and the employees of those stores and buildings feeling helpless to enforce that, or sometimes trying to force people out of a store. With the close proximity and how important the T is for people to get to and from work to get to places they need to go, how do you help them feel safe?
I mean, we have put forward a pretty extensive campaign, Ride Safer, where we're asking people to wear masks. We've got visuals in many of our stations and our buses, again, asking people to wear masks. When I ride on the system, I see people wearing masks. People are, by and large, complying. And, you know, I hope people continue to do so. I do think mask wearing has sort of become normative now around when you're out and around, at least in the greater Boston area. And I hope that continues. It is a troubling trend nationally where I think it's gotten wrapped up in a bunch of other issues. It's the right thing to do from a public health perspective when we're asking our riders to comply.
So you're dropping prices starting September 1st. So cash and Charlie ticket prices are going to be lowered to match Charlie card prices.
Yes.
Price decreases are not something we see a lot. What was the thinking here and why started on September 1st?
The thinking was this is something that a broad group of advocates had asked for, so that folks who do not have a Charlie card but are using cash or a Charlie ticket were in effect paying a surcharge, and they were saying that the prices should be equalized. So that's something that the board decided they wanted to do this year. So we put it in place. It is the precursor to a much larger multi-year fare transformation project, which is going to phase out the use, not right now, but eventually phase out the use of cash on buses and also give people a lot more options in terms of the fare media that they can use. If you still want to use some variant of the Charlie card, you can, but you'll also be able to use a bunch of different other types of media.
You have said elsewhere that everything's on the table in terms of what might have to happen or ideas to close the gap and get the T back to financial stability. What might not happen that you have planned for in order to close this gap? What might go away?
You know, I think we're right at the beginning of a public dialogue on this. We want to present to the board some options. So we are looking at everything, in terms of being aggressive about new revenue sources. Unfortunately, right now, a lot of the things that we depend on for revenue, like parking, isn't being that utilized. So we can tweak that all we want. It's not necessarily going to get us significant new revenue. And we'll also be taking a look at service. Where are the places where we might need additional service, and where are the places where perhaps we're providing service and we don't necessarily have the ridership? So, everything is on the table at this point.
Steve, I know you know that riders sometimes have a love-hate relationship with the T. Love the T, rely on it, love the freedom of it, get frustrated with some of the history of derailments, the challenges, for example, of the winter of 2015, maintenance that's been deferred. But now we have this moment where it feels like the economy is saying the T is existentially in threat, and no one wants that. What do we do to make sure our T is still here for all our riders?
This is why we've engaged in this process now, right? We have a budget for the next fiscal year that is balanced. We need to start planning now. We need to attempt to set aside as much money as we can to address the gap in FY22, and that's what we're doing. I expect that we will have difficult conversations this fall, but I think the intent is to make sure that we preserve an MBTA that works for this region. And we preserve a base here at the MBTA that at some point in the future, we can begin to build out from again.
And that is Steve Poftak, the general manager of the MBTA. Steve, I appreciate you joining us. Good to talk to you on Radio Boston again.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Now, August is not usually playoff season, let's be honest, but this year we have two Boston teams roaring into the second round of their respective playoffs. So what better time to check the score with Radio Boston's Chris Siderek. Chris, welcome back.
Hey, Tiziana.
Well, and there is so much sports news that it takes two. So also joining us is Howard Bryant, senior writer for ESPN and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Howard, welcome back to you too.
Hey, Tatiana. How are you doing?
Great to have you. Thanks. So listen, last time we talked about sports on Radio Boston, the big question we were asking was who was going to win in the battle between professional sports and the coronavirus? It's been playing out for several weeks now. I'll start with you, Chris. What do you think?
I think it's kind of a mixed bag. I would give you the cliff note answer that basketball and hockey are winning. I think baseball is losing and football is kind of doing that plug your ears, la, 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 I can't hear you to some of the warning signs they're getting. Howard, I don't know. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I think that the bubble is what's winning. If you are non-bubble, exactly. You're in all kinds of trouble. And certainly I think that the college sports and college sports, pro football especially, they've had so much more time than everybody else to have a plan, and it still feels like they don't really have one.
How is that possible? Seriously, how is it possible to not have a plan at this point?
Well, I tend to think that what really happened in the NFL when this all went down in March is that they felt like this wasn't their season. It wasn't going to affect them, that this was all going to be in the past by summertime, and it wasn't. And I think in college, I think the big issue with college, Chris, interested in your thoughts on that too, is that I think that in college, I believe that they didn't recognize how much of a gap there was going to be between shutting down the campuses and still making the athletes show up. And so there's a huge question about amateurism and everything else that that coronavirus has really unleashed.
Yeah, absolutely. And Tiziana, I would say, I think we've seen this kind of across the whole spectrum of life, right? Like schools don't seem to have a fully fleshed out plan as we're approaching the new school year. I think this virus is so new and unique. No one really understood what exactly we were dealing with, and everybody kind of approached it with a wishful thinking sort of mindset that, as Howard said, by the time fall rolls around, we'll be through the worst of it. Clearly, that doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, I also would throw one other thing, too, actually. Just a quick other thing is that I think there was also a shift in the summertime. And I think somewhere along the line, there was this let's get on with it shift that, okay, well, you know, every war has casualties, and I think that people have just decided that, hey, if this is what life is going to be like, we all need to get on with it. And especially when pro teams are looking at the financials, they're looking at it saying, we can't go forward unless, and we're not going to take these losses.
All right, so let's talk about the pro teams for a minute. And Chris, it's dealer's choice. We got three Boston pro teams playing right now, Bruins, Celtics, and the Sox. Where are you going to start?
I am loving this, first of all, in terms of the buffet that we're getting in terms of options here, although no one really wants a buffet these days. I'm going to start Bruins because I think this team has been so much fun to watch. We've got game two coming up tonight in the second round against Tampa Bay Lightning. It's the first night of a back-to-back, which does not happen in hockey playoffs ever. So this is going to be a really interesting test in terms of stamina and keeping up that energy. You know, you could wake up on Thursday and the Bruins could be up 3-0 in this series just like that. So I think it's going to be a really interesting game tonight. And again, this team is a fun team to watch.
Yeah.
Okay. But Howard, Chris is gaga about the Bruins. So let me just ask you too, are you loving this team as much as he does? And are they going to be up by 3 on Thursday?
Well, that's two different questions there. I think it's
I didn't predict that. Just all right.
I do not see the Bruins winning 3 in a row over Tampa Bay. One of my favorite cliches is these two teams do not like each other, and they don't, and they're going to be doing a lot of fighting and a lot of pushing around tonight. I think the thing that I like most about this Bruins team is that they've actually walked the walk pretty well in a couple of really important areas. One is that nobody sort of went rogue on Tuukka Rask, and maybe they're to be believed. Maybe they really do believe that they lost their goalie and he chose not to play and opt out, and they're not going to penalize him for it. And also Yaroslav Halak, the backup goaltender, is like, hey, I've been a playoff goalie before. This is my time to shine. This is great. And then also you've got players like David Pastrnak, who hadn't played a couple of games either due to injury or, you know, the unable to perform COVID type of why isn't he on the ice question. And they've sort of survived it all. And they're actually looking better than they have since restart began.
Yeah, I want to pick up on that, Howard, because I think that's really interesting. Tuukka Rask pulled out, you know, 90 minutes before game three of the last round. It was a complete surprise, it seemed, to the whole team, citing we think there's some sort of family emergency there. So he wanted to spend time with his family. Halak has really picked it up and just kind of, they didn't seem to miss a step sliding him into the net. I'm curious kind of what you think of his performance.
Well, outside of the one giveaway goal against Carolina, he's been great. And I think that the players realize that he needs more help. They certainly have focused defensively to make sure that he's not as exposed. But I think also I really went into this final four in the Eastern Conference thinking that the Bruins had the best line. They've got the best perfection line of all the teams. But at the same time, I thought they had the weakest goalie. And so I think sometimes what you see is you see the professionalism of some of the players of a guy like Halak going, wait a minute, I'm not the weak link. Let me prove that I'm just as good as everybody else. I may be your asset.
So, Chris, I want to take us all the way back to more innocent times at the beginning of the first part of the hockey season when you were trying to get me emotionally involved with the Bruins because you were very excited about them. And then when they came back, you sounded concerned. You don't sound concerned now.
No, I really think there was a moment where they flipped the switch. And I want to highlight two specific plays because I think there were such huge moments in terms of this team and the whole attitude you're seeing up and down the lineup. And Howard, you can probably guess where I'm going here, but basically we're going back to game four of the last round.
Charlie.
And it starts, the Bruins were down, 2-0, and they had outshot the Hurricanes. They seemed to be outplaying the Hurricanes, but they couldn't get the puck in the net. And then Jake DeBrusk on a breakaway has to dive to get over the goalie to finish the play. Here's what it sounds like.
Niederreiter tears his stick loose. Krejci, now Kasha. Jake DeBrusk in alone and scores! Getting away from Florian, dodging Reimer's kamikaze attempt to stop Jake DeBrusk.
So just about 2 minutes later after that, Charlie McAvoy, who has really come into his own during these playoffs, is a young defenseman, really kind of stepping into that number one defenseman role, puts a huge hit on Hurricanes' Jordan Staal. Here's a little bit of what that sounded like.
Loose near the crease. Marchand battling for the puck. Jordan Staal, what a hit by McAvoy. You don't see Jordan Staal get knocked down that much.
He's still down, I think.
Wow.
So I just thought that was a huge swing of momentum. The Bruins end up scoring four goals in that third period. They take the 3-1 series lead. Instead of maybe going seven games against the Hurricanes, they get to close it out early and move on. Howard, do you think those two plays really kind of sparked this team?
100%. And in the other direction, I really thought that the number of giveaways early in the series, when you know the Pastrnak when they were on the power play, he gives up a shorthanded goal there, and I was like, they are going to make this thing. They're going to drag this thing all the way up to seven. They keep letting Carolina back into it, and then all of a sudden the Staal hit. When he got laid out like that, you could see that Carolina looked around and they're like, we can't win. And you know, and that hits like that changed the series. That hit reminded me very much of when Nathan Horton got hit in the Stanley Cup in 2011, and it galvanized the Bruins, and suddenly they became a different team. So absolutely, those two were the big momentum changers, and it allowed the Bruins to sort of get out of that sort of rust area that they were in terms of restart, because restart's not about who was the best team during the season. Restart is all about who's the best team during the restart, who can deal with the fact that there are no fans and who can deal with the fact that the energy is gone and that they hadn't played for 4 months. Whoever adjusts to that the best is going to be the best team when it's all said and done.
All right, Chris and Howard, we've got just a few minutes left, and I don't want to miss out on the Celtics. They have been so much fun. They're just such a fun team to watch. Great series against the 76ers. Now moving on. How are we feeling about them?
You know, I'm loving them. Go ahead, Howard. You take this one first.
I'll be real quick. It had never happened before that the Philadelphia 76ers got swept by the Celtics in a playoff series. It couldn't have happened to a better bunch of guys, because the Sixers talked so much trash. They got humiliated, and then their coach got fired. Toronto is going to be a totally different animal, but that was a fun series to watch if you're a Celtics fan.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Tiziana. This is a really fun team to watch. You've got a really talented young core that's stepping up and giving them multiple scoring options. You've got Marcus Smart leading the way on this kind of tough-nosed defense, really putting the best effort on the floor, diving for loose balls. Things like that make a difference, especially in basketball, and the other guys are really kind of feeding off that energy.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're watching a superstar in Jason Tatum. You're watching him right in front of your eyes become something really special.
Yeah, I think Jaylen Brown, too. I think both those guys have really stepped up.
Agreed.
And Gordon Hayward's injury, which looked like it might be just catastrophic for the team. I mean, it's terrible, but the team seems to be doing all right without him.
We'll see. I think you're going to feel his absence against Toronto because Toronto's really, really good. Philadelphia was not really, really good. I think the real difference here is going to be you're going to need Jaylen Brown to be more active. He's somebody you're not going to lose a Gordon Hayward and feel absolutely nothing, but this team's a good, you know, the Celtics are a surprising team, but I do feel like somewhere along the line, you don't have a player at that caliber and you just move on without him.
Yeah. And they have shown that can respond to adversity pretty well too, in terms of either giving up leads or coming back from behind. So I do think that's an optimistic sign.
Okay. Speaking of adversity, Chris, one question only, cause it's just too painful. The Boston Red Sox are they're competing for one of the worst seasons in their history. What is going on?
Yeah, I mean, it's been brutal. Look, we've talked about it since the trade deadline last year. I just think the ownership approach to this group of guys they have on the field, it's been clear. They're trying to shed payroll. They're trying to build for a long-term future as opposed to trying to win right now. And that makes for a really frustrating product on the field.
And Howard, before we go, I want to come back to a pretty serious subject for a minute. You've written a number of books about athletes and activism. I wanted to ask you what you thought about former football star Herschel Walker speaking at the Republican National Convention in support of President Trump yesterday, saying in part, quote, "It hurts my soul to hear the terrible names that people call Donald. The worst one is racist," end quote. He played for the New Jersey Generals in the 80s when Donald Trump was the owner. What's your reaction to seeing him speaking there?
No, I had no reaction other than the fact that I thought it was a ridiculous thing for him to say that Donald Trump had paid attention to the history of the league. The league had only been in existence 1 year when he bought it. So I just thought, you know, it just struck me as more celebrity branding. It didn't have a whole lot of value to me. Herschel Walker has the right to how Herschel Walker thinks. It didn't have a lot of value at all.
All right, let me stay with you and then ask you this last question, then we'll give it Chris a chance to answer too. Cam Newton, New England Patriots. Is he the new Tom Brady on the New England Patriots? Or more to the point, is Cam Newton the new Cam Newton starter on the New England Patriots?
Well, if Cam Newton can play like he did in 2015 when they went and he took Carolina to the Super Bowl, I think everybody will be happy with that. My big thing about the NFL is I just want to see if they play, number one.
Yeah, that's a big question mark. I mean, we saw they even had some problems with false positive tests, which caused a bunch of teams across the league to have to kind of postpone practices and things like that. So who knows what that happens once the season's actually in full swing, how they deal with that kind of thing. Never mind if there's an actual outbreak. But I've said from day one when they brought Cam Newton in here, he's the starter. He's the most talented of the three quarterbacks they have on the roster. No doubt in my mind, until he shows he can't play at that level, he's got to be the starter.
All right. Well, at least sports are giving us some fun stuff to think about right now. That's Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
And Howard Bryant, ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday. Howard, great to have you with us. Thanks.
No, thank you.
Thousands of students are going back to Boston University and Northeastern University this week and next, the two largest universities in the city of Boston, and we want to talk about it. But I have to be transparent right off the top here because I moved my own freshman daughter, Simone, into a Boston University dorm this past weekend. And once the bed sheets were on and the suitcases were empty and everything was all unpacked, we had a brand new item on our move-in list. It was her first COVID test, which she was required to get the day she moved in.
There was a little tube with some liquid in it. And on top of that, there was a swab. I told you not to touch the swab with your hands. So you unscrewed the swab, put it in both nostrils, swirled it around a little bit, then put it down into the liquid of the tube and closed it again. And then you just gave them the tube. So it took about 5 minutes.
Now, whether you have a college-age kid or not, with dozens of colleges and universities in Greater Boston, this uncharted territory of keeping students and communities safe while supporting student learning is essential, so we're going to delve into it. And to do that, we have two people who are involved in these decisions. One is joining us now, and we expect to have the other on the line soon. So we're joined right now by Dr. David Hamer. He's a professor of global health at Boston University's School of Public Health and School of Medicine, and also a member of the medical advisory group, which advises the university on the public health measures and recommendations being implemented on campus this fall. Dr. Hamer, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're glad to have you. And that was perfect because we now have our other guest with us as well, Kathy Spiegelman, who is Vice President and Chief of Campus Planning and Development at Northeastern. Kathy, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
And listeners, you, are you a parent, a student, a neighbor of a college or university? How do you feel about campuses reopening? Do you have questions for our experts? You can call us, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Okay, Dr. Hamer, I want to start by touching on some of the big headlines in college reopenings over the last couple of weeks. Both the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and Notre Dame have moved to fully remote learning after the coronavirus clusters on campus. University of Alabama and Tuscaloosa just reported over 500 confirmed cases. I want to ask you, what are you doing to make sure a similar situation doesn't play out at your school?
Well, that's a good question. I think that we've looked at some of the strategies that these other universities have taken, and I think we're taking a much more broad approach. I would say even more aggressive. So as you mentioned, with the case of your daughter, at Boston University, we are requiring everyone who arrives to be tested on arrival. If a student's moving in from a state that has higher levels of transmission than Massachusetts, New York, New England, then they're advised to do quarantine for the first 14 days, although we may clear them from quarantine sooner if they have three negative tests. The move-in is being done in a de-densified way so that people have to schedule the day they move in. Normally, it's a three-day period that everyone returns to campus. It's spread out over 15 days or thereabouts. And there's just a lot of different additional measures, but I think testing is a real key part of it. We've built a laboratory to do our own testing, and the turnaround time in tests is less than 24 hours. This is important because if a student's identified who is infected, then they need to be isolated. And so we have isolation dorm rooms that we've developed. And once they're in isolation, they have to stay there for at least 10 days or potentially a little longer if they've had symptoms with their illness. And they would do their classes from those isolation rooms. UNC, as just an example, didn't have a sufficient number of isolation beds, and they very rapidly filled them. But they also had a different testing strategy. We're going to be testing students twice a week, as well as faculty and staff that have a lot of student-facing contact or a lot of time on campus. Others will be tested once a week or potentially less often if they say it's a faculty member that's only intermittently on campus. So testing is a key part of it, as well as isolation and then contact tracing to see if there have been any close contacts of students that are infected. Those people are identified quickly, placed in quarantine, and if they become symptomatic, then additional testing is done. Let me sort of stop there.
Thanks, because I'd love to hear from Kathy Spiegelman as well what the plan is at Northeastern. I know you just made a change and students will be tested, I believe, every 3 days there. And I know BU has more students on campus now that the timing for Northeastern is a little further out. So what's your process look like and what are you guys doing?
Well, it looks very much like what was just described. I'm not the testing expert, but I have been following very closely because my team has been working on setting up the testing facility, both the lab and the testing facility, and your daughter's description is very similar to what's been going on. We've done 8,000 tests so far. The move-in system for us sounds a little bit different. Our move-in's happening over 11 days. It usually happens over 3 to 5. And we're doing that in order to reduce the density and allow us to have the stream of people coming in and getting tested to be handled as conveniently and easily as possible. The parents of our students will not be going up to their dorm rooms and making their beds and setting them up. They've been notified that no visitors are going to come into the dorms during move-in. As soon as a family arrives at their assigned time, the student will be sent over to pick up their what we call their Husky card, go directly to the testing center, and then go directly to their room, where they will be technically in quarantine until their test results come back negative. Obviously, if the test results don't come back negative, they will be transferred to the beds that we're reserving that we call wellness beds, which will be used both for students who test positive but also through the contact tracing for students who've been exposed, in order to make sure that we take them out of contact with a lot of the rest of the community. So I think it sounds very similar to BU. I think the differences that were described by the doctor are also the differences at Northeastern from some of the other universities that have run into the difficulties that you described. I will say that because I spend a lot more time thinking about the physical campus and how we are handling all the things that living and learning activities require under the guidance of the CDC and the Department of Public Health. So lots of attention, lots of signage, lots of we have a campaign called Protect the Pack, which reinforces for students their responsibility to protect themselves and each other with healthy distancing, wearing masks on campus, washing their hands, and then following all of the other protocols that we've developed about reducing the density in our classrooms and our dining facilities, cleaning, air handling in our buildings, but mm-hmm. also paying attention to the public realm, because we know that our students are not just going to be in the dorms and in the classrooms. They're coming back to campus. They're coming to Boston to live their campus life, and we're very anxious for them to be able to do that, to pursue their education without any disruption for the surrounding community or for our, everybody else who's on the campus.
So to that point of the public realm, and listeners, we just got very detailed explanations of exactly what is happening at these two huge institutions in Boston as students come back. What is your reaction? Does it make you feel safer? Are there concerns? Do you have clarifying questions? What do you want to see from the university in your community in terms of learning and safety? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. These are massive investments, massive measures that you're both talking about. What do you say to the listener who says, I appreciate all of that, but students simply should not be back on campus? It's too risky, and you cannot control their choices and behaviors when they're not in the dorms or in the buildings. Why is being on campus important enough to make it worth all of this, Dr. Hamer?
I think it's important for students to have, you know, both interaction with other students, but to be able to directly interact with faculty, to have an in-class experience. And I think some students may learn very well, you know, via Zoom or other modalities, but others don't. And I think that and then being able to do collaborative projects with other students, in person rather than over the internet. I think all of these are really important components of the student's education, and not offering them that opportunity, that they, I think that it really changes the whole sort of tenure or feel for students' education.
And Karen Spiegelman, what do you do about the challenges of off-campus life? So many of the stories that we're hearing about new clusters emerging at universities as students go back keep coming back to, it was that off-campus party where people didn't wear masks, they didn't practice social distancing.
So the campaign that I described called Protect the Pack includes a series of communications and also compliance reinforcement, a tip line, some extra staffing and ambassadors to be working with students, whether they are living in Northeastern housing or they're living in other housing in the community. I will echo the idea that we believe that the education of our students is very important, that their choices to be able to participate in the living and learning that happens on campus is important, that our students are choosing to want, many of our students, not all, some are choosing to actually pursue their education virtually, and we've given them that option to do it. But I think the testing and the protocols and the way the contact tracing and the things that we're doing on campus, we hope actually makes our students a cohort of citizens within the Boston community who actually are practicing all the things that we hope everybody in the Boston community is practicing, because we all have a responsibility to each other under this pandemic to be looking out for the health of ourselves and our neighbors. So
Let's
we are really committed to doing it, and we're asking our students to be committed along with us.
I want to go to the phones before I do. Kathy, I called you Karen a minute ago. I'm so sorry.
No problem.
I know it's Kathy. That was a brain lapse. Let's go to the phones, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've got Donna on the line from Brockton. Donna, go ahead.
I just wanted to know if there's going to be clear consequences for students that party or congregate and don't socially distance like they're supposed to, like we've seen on the news. If there's going to be clear consequences, are they going to be taken out of school, just like for any other thing that they do bad, like plagiarism or fighting or anything like that? Are there going to be clear consequences that this is not accepted at all?
Thanks, That's Donna. All. And Kathy, I think you touched on that a second ago, right? Saying that
yes,
there were
the
at Northeastern?
Absolutely, the answer is absolutely yes. We understand that we can only protect each other and be the kind of citizens and members of the community that we want to be by making it clear that those big gatherings where people are not wearing masks, are not practicing the safe protocols that we've established, will not be allowed.
And I want to grab another call here, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jill, you're on from South Boston. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jill. I'm a graduate of Boston University of 2017, and I just wanted to add, I think that the value of being on campus is so important to student life, and, you know, gave so much to me as a student during my 4 years, and I think that the way that the university has implemented the measures would make me feel completely safe as a student. I just looked over their 20-page comprehensive Get Back to Campus plan, and I feel, you know, I would feel completely safe, and there is a lot of personal responsibility that goes into it as well. So I think the students have everything at their fingertips, and they just need to choose to implement and make the good decisions. And
thanks, Jill.
I think I commend BU for that.
Thank you, Jill. And Dr. Hamer, stay put because we have a second call about BU. I'll take them both and then give you a chance to respond. We've got Jason on the line from Stoneham. Jason, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I'm actually a faculty member at BU. And I have to call into question whether it's worth letting students prioritizing student learning over public health. And I know for a fact, as a faculty member, that students are not going to get much of an in-class experience. Most of the learning is going to be online at BU, so that's really false advertising.
All right, thank you for that call. So two very different perspectives there from, and obviously we can't confirm that Jill's an alum and Jason is faculty, but two very different calls about BU there. Dr. Hamer, what are your responses?
First of all, I'd like to thank Jill for her positive comments. We put a lot of time into the return to campus plan. It's very detailed. It is a little long, but I think it's thorough and comprehensive, and with the aim of trying to make the campus as safe as possible to maintain the health of, you know, faculty, staff, and students. I slightly disagree with Jason. You know, I think you're partly right. There's going to be a mixture of in-class and out-of-class experience. Students have the option of taking everything remotely. Some are doing that. All classrooms have had mapping done to determine appropriate density. I'm going to be teaching starting in, I guess, a week and a half or so, and the classroom that I have allows up to 16 students. I teach a seminar type course and we have 23 enrolled. So at any one time, like 3/4 or 2/3 of the class could be present. I don't think they're all going to choose to be present, but you know, I think that many will have an in-class experience. Some are opting out of that, and that's their choice. Others may, you know, go for a mix, but I think it's not going to be all online unless, of course, things explode and there's a big outbreak and we exceed isolation or quarantine capacity. But I think with all the measures we have in place, with good enforcement and good sort of, you know, personal responsibility, that this is unlikely to happen.
So I want to zero in, Kathy, on something Dr. Hamer just said. Dr. Hamer, you said unless things explode and you get beyond capacity. And that has been a question. What is the threshold for shutting it down? Is it a certain level of positivity and test rates? Is it overflow on isolation and quarantine? What is that metric?
I think there's no single metric. Kathy,
I am so sorry. We have lost your sound quality. I heard you say, I think there's no single metric, but we've lost your sound quality. I apologize for that. Dr. Hamer, I'm going to let you pick it up. We'll see if we can get Kathy back.
Okay, so we have developed some metrics and are actually working on even more complex metrics. I think the real simple ones are going to be monitoring our use of isolation rooms and quarantine rooms. And if we're reaching capacity for those, we will, I'd say even if we reach like 75% capacity, that we're going to be concerned. And certainly if we reach full capacity, we would have to change our strategies. But I think we would want to do that earlier in order to try and avoid that happening. We've got a group of really smart medical epidemiologists and statisticians, mathematicians that are helping to really try and analyze both local data from the state of Massachusetts and the surrounding counties, but also on-campus data to try and determine the rate of transmission, the sort of estimated rate of transmission and how that's changing. If we see that it looks like it's increasing, then that will be another measure that will cause us to change practice and potentially change the strategies.
Okay, and we do have Kathy Spiegelman back now. So in a follow-up question in our last minute, Kathy, are you confident that that set of forward-looking metrics is enough to keep an outbreak from happening, or is it inevitable and this is get as much on-campus time as you can before the inevitable happens?
Oh my, I don't know that I want to put myself in the position of having to predict everything that you just asked me to take a firm position on.
Fair enough.
I will tell you, though, that we, for the past 6 months, as we have pivoted to all of the concerns that you've begun to raise, that callers have raised about what it means to bring our students, faculty, and staff back to campus, we believe that the measures, all the ones that were described at BU, all the ones that I've had a chance to describe to you today, are measures that will counter the likelihood of an outbreak, and that we will be watching it very closely because public health and safety is the number one priority for everything that we're doing. And we believe that we can carry it out. So I hope that we maybe can have a conversation at the end of the semester, and we can all say that all the things that we're doing actually were successful.
And that's Kathy Spiegelman, Vice President and Chief of Campus Planning and Development at Northeastern. Thank you, Kathy.
Okay, you're welcome.
And Dr. David Hamer, Professor of Global Health at BU School of Public Health and School of Medicine and a member of the Medical Advisory Group. Thank you so much for joining us again.
My pleasure.